You cannot serve both God and money. The topic that's been given to me by authorities higher than me is how to handle money. I used to work in fundraising. Well, sometimes I think I'm still working in fundraising. Probably anyone who's in business thinks they're working in fundraising, but I know when I was more active in fundraising with World Vision, we used to say we want lots of money to pass through our hands and none of it to stick to our fingers. So it's not a bad principle for fundraisers, I think. A young man was talking to God. "How long is 1,000,000 years to you, God?" he asked. "1,000,000 years to me is like a single second to you," God replied. "Oh, how much is $1,000,000 to you?" the young man asked. "$1,000,000 to me is like a 5-cent coin to you," God replied. "In that case," the young man ventured, "could I have one of your 5-cent coins?" God replied, "Certainly. Wait a second." I remember a long while ago being at a church function of some sort. It was probably a stewardship seminar. I hardly remember the occasion, but I remember they had this one speaker who was talking to us about money, and he made this claim. He said, "The Bible talks more about money than it does about anything else. The Bible talks more about money than it does about everything else." And I was a bit offended by this, because up to that point I thought the Bible talked about God's love and faithfulness more than it talked about anything else. So I went home and did some research, and I discovered that indeed in the New Testament riches or money or wealth are mentioned 90 times in the New Testament. And I can tell you that the word love is in there 200 times. So I don't think he was actually right, but he was on the right track in the sense that obviously money and riches and wealth is a very important topic. It's mentioned a lot in the New Testament, both in the things that Jesus says and in the things that St. Paul says. In fact, St. Paul actually writes a fundraising direct mail letter in the Bible. Does anyone know where it is? Nobody. Well, if you read 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9, you'll find it's a fundraising letter. It's a direct mail, like the sort you get from charities today. It says, "You made a promise to give us this amount of money. Please send it in with this coupon." Now, he doesn't have a coupon. He actually has a bloke to come and collect it, which is probably more effective than a coupon. But the principles in this in these two chapters are exactly the same principles that fundraisers use today to write direct mail fundraising appeal letters. In fact, I have a one-hour seminar that I teach occasionally to people who write fundraising letter copy, and it's called The Eternal Principles of Fundraising, and I quite openly use 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, which surprises some of the people who've never opened their Bible or even have one who attend this particular workshop, because the principles that Paul uses in urging the Corinthians to deliver on their promise to give to the poor are the same principles that are used today. They're eternal principles, and in fact they're biblical and godly principles. But what exactly does the Bible teach us about how to handle money? Now, when you ask people that question, a lot of people focus on one particular incident, the story of Jesus' encounter with the rich young ruler. Now, the story goes that as Jesus went out into the street, a man came running up. He greeted Jesus with great reverence, and he asked, "Good teacher, what must I do to get eternal life?" Well, Jesus says, "Keep God's commandments. You know, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, etc." Doesn't actually say etc., but you get the idea. And the young bloke says, "Teacher, since I was a little kid, I've kept all these commandments." And then Jesus looks him in the eye, and his heart really goes out to him, and Jesus says, "You know, there's one thing left. Go and sell whatever you own and give it to the poor. All your wealth will be heavenly wealth. And come and follow me." Now, lots of people think that this call on the rich young ruler is a call for everybody, that this call to voluntary poverty and obedience to Jesus is a call for everyone. And they have this idea that poverty somehow is next to godliness. Actually, it's cleanliness that's next to godliness, in case you're not sure. And that's not in the Bible either. That was John Wesley. So they think poverty is next to godliness. Well, not quite true, because although Jesus does rail against those who use improper or evil means to get their money, for example, he made Zacchaeus, who had extorted money out of taxpayers, he made him, well, he didn't make him, he asked him, he told him, to pay it all back four times over, and we understand Zacchaeus did that. So Jesus has railed against that kind of improper acquisition of money, but only to this one young man does he tell him to get rid of the lot. And you remember what happened, of course. Did the young man get rid of the lot? No. The man's face clouded over. That was the last thing he expected to hear. And he walked off with a heavy heart because he was holding on tight to a lot of things and he wasn't about to let go. I wonder whether he was holding on to his money or was his money holding on to him. I think there are four ways, if you look at the Bible, that Jesus talks about money. And I think the first thing is that Jesus tells us it's actually okay to have money. When Joseph of Arimathea came to Pontius Pilate to ask for the body of Jesus, Matthew describes Joseph as a rich man, one of the followers of Jesus. A rich man, one of the followers of Jesus. Evidently, Jesus hadn't asked him to sell everything he owned before he followed him. And it's generally thought that Nicodemus was a rich man. Nicodemus, the man whom Jesus said, you must be born again. Evidently, he didn't say, you must sell all you have and then be born again. And Jesus knew the importance of ministry to his ministry, and he used it. He surrounded, well, maybe surrounded is not the right word, so I was going to say surrounded himself with women. He had a group of women who supported the disciples. Perhaps it says more about how gender was thought of in those days that they're not actually recorded as disciples. But we do know the names of three of these women, and we know that they were wealthy and that they paid for, I guess, food and other stuff that the disciples needed. You know, they looked after the administration costs of running the Jesus ministry of those days. And Luke names three of these. There's Mary Magdalene, who's well known. She wasn't a prostitute. Don't believe everything you read in the Da Vinci Code. Anyway, that's another story. Susanna is another one, and Joanna. And this Joanna, and Luke records it this way, she was married to the chief executive of the king's palace. The chief executive of the king's palace. So you can expect that she had a dollar or two to her name. So Jesus says it's okay to have money. That's the first thing. Then I also think he says it's okay to make money. You know, he tells that story certainly uses the idea of investing and generating wealth in a very positive way, the story of the talents. Now, this is not the main message of the talents, but it's in there as well. Jesus tells the story about one servant being given 10 and another 5 and another 2, and how the ones with the 10 and 5 do a good job of doubling their investment, actually. Obviously, it was boom times. And the 2 goes and buries it in the yard, and Jesus, or at least in the story, Jesus is very critical of the one who wastes the opportunity to generate more wealth. So it's okay to have money, it's okay to make money, and it's okay to save money. Jesus approves of saving. You've probably heard that story about the evangelical graffiti artist who wrote Jesus Saves beside the tram tracks or the railway tracks, and then someone came along right underneath it at the Westpac. Well, I think probably both interpretations, Jesus would have said, are correct. Well, maybe not at the Westpac, but the idea of saving money is something that Jesus does not condemn. And in fact, he criticizes some people who don't save enough to look after their families. And in fact, he says, more or less, that you better look after your families before you give money to the church. Which is a bit disturbing, I know, Ken, but there it is. I think, well, actually what he says is, don't use the excuse of giving to the church not to look after your families. That's actually what he says, right? Don't use the excuse of giving your tithe or your contribution to the church as an excuse for not looking after your families. So it's okay to save so that you've got money to look after your families. Honour your father and mother. And saving might be an important part of that. So it's okay to have money, it's okay to make money, it's okay to save money. And then fourthly, I think Jesus says it's okay to enjoy the things that money can buy. Now, notice I didn't say to enjoy money, to enjoy the things that money can buy. Because these are from God. This is part of God's providence. Money enables us to get good things that God provides, and to enjoy them. When Paul's writing to Timothy, he says, tell those who are rich not to be proud and not to trust in their money, which will soon be gone, but put their pride and trust in the living God, who always richly gives us all we need for our enjoyment. God gives us all we need for our enjoyment. So enjoy. It's clear that Jesus did. He accepted invitations to dine with rich people. There's one famous story in Luke chapter 11 where the rich Pharisees and legal experts invite Jesus to a dinner, and they lay on a meal for him, and he goes along and he really has a good time. Better time than the rich Pharisees and legal experts, actually, if you read the story. They're probably sorry they invited him in the end. But he obviously had the wine and ate the meal and so on. And you'll remember that when Jesus went to a wedding in Cana and the wine ran out, he improved things quite considerably. Don't you wish you could lay a hand on that vintage? I wonder what wine made by Jesus tastes like. Heavenly, yeah. Actually, I think there's a life group opportunity here. Now, don't go the wrong way with this, but just occurs to me there's a little interesting theological exploration there between, if you think about the wine that Jesus made at Cana and the wine of the Eucharist, you could... Okay, I see I'm losing you here. Bit of mission creep going on, I think. Okay, if they had these authoritative publications like New Idea around in Jesus' time, I'm sure too the whole bad PR that Jesus got would have been splashed on the pages. Pictures of Jesus dining with sinners and, you know, eating food, because they called him a glutton and a, what was it? A drinking man. Glutton and a drinking man, yes. And hanging around with the worst kinds of sinners. So this was the reputation that Jesus had. Jesus obviously knew how to enjoy himself and how to enjoy the good things that could be, that came from the hand of God, and some of which required money to buy. I don't reckon Jesus is particularly worried about money. But I think he's really worried about the love of money. You cannot serve both God and money. But if you have money, you can use it to serve God. And that's how St. Paul deals with how to handle money. He says to Timothy, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And in their eagerness to be rich, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains." The love of money, all kinds of evil. Love of money draws you away from the faith. He says, tell those who are rich in this world's wealth to quit being so full of themselves and so obsessed with money, which is here today and gone tomorrow. Tell them to go after God, who piles on all the riches we could imagine. Tell them to do good. Tell the rich to be rich in helping others. Tell the rich to be extravagantly generous. If they do that, they'll build a treasury that will last, gaining life that is truly life. So if you're rich, get your priorities right. God first, then use your riches to do good, use your riches to help others, use your riches to be extravagantly generous. There was a man who had worked hard all his life and made a lot of money, and he'd saved all of his money. But he was a real miser when it came to distributing his money, and he kept it all to himself. And just before he died, he said to his wife, "When I die, I want to take all my money, and I want you to take all my money and put it in the coffin with me. I want to take my money with me." And so he got his wife to promise him with all of her heart that when he died, she would put all of the money in the coffin with him. Well, he died, and he was stretched out in the coffin, and his wife was sitting there in black, and her friend was sitting next to her. And when they finished the ceremony, just before the undertakers came to seal up the coffin, the wife said, "Wait just a minute," and she had this box with her. She came over with the box and she put it in the coffin. And then the undertakers locked the coffin down and they rolled it away. So her friend sitting next to her said, "Surely you weren't fool enough to put all that money in there with your husband?" And she said, "Don't call me Shirley." No, sorry, that's a different joke. She said, "I'm a Christian. I can't go back on my word. I promised him that I was going to put that money in that coffin with him." And her friend said, "You mean to tell me you put all that money in the coffin with him?" "I sure did," said the wife. "I wrote him a check. If he can cash it, he can spend it." There are a number of great sermons. There are a few original ones. This is not an original one. Because the theme from this comes from a sermon that was preached about 250 years ago by a great Anglican evangelical thought to be a Methodist. Sermon number 50 by John Wesley is titled The Use of Money. And you can read all of John Wesley's sermons on the web these days. You know that? I didn't know that till I was researching for this. Let me summarise what John Wesley says. He says, make as much money as you can, save as much money as you can, give as much money as you can. Make as much money as you can, save as much money as you can, give as much money as you can. Wesley said, the right use of money is of the utmost importance to the Christian, yet it's a subject given too little attention. Wealth has often been regarded by poets and philosophers as a source of evil. And yet the fault lies not with the money, but with those who use it. Indeed, money should be regarded as a gift of God for the benefits that it brings in ordering the affairs of civilization and the opportunities it offers for doing good. In the hands of God's children, money is food for the hungry. Money is clothing for the naked and shelter for the stranger. With money we can care for the widow and the fatherless. With money you can defend the oppressed. With money you can meet the need of those who are sick or in pain. So, make as much money as you can, save as much money as you can, give as much money as you can. Now, according to Wesley, there are some conditions to be observed, some limits to be placed on making, saving and giving. First of all, he says, you shouldn't make money at the expense of your life or health. And I think it's not too hard to understand what he's saying there. There are too many workaholics, too many people who live only to make money. And their life and their health and their family life and their relationships suffer, may be destroyed by getting up before the sun and coming home after the sun goes down. Not the way to live. Too much stress, heart attacks. My uncle died at the age of 50. He was a workaholic. Early deaths from making money. So first, we shouldn't make money at the expense of life and health. Secondly, he said, we shouldn't make money at the expense of our minds. Now, some jobs will send you crazy, simply because you're completely unsuited for them, right? If I was mayor of Knox, I would become a raving lunatic. More so, right. Some people are gifted for this kind of thing. Some people are not. Politics is definitely not my game, right? The number of things I can't do, right? If I had to be a nurse in the caring professions, I know I couldn't do that. I don't have the wherewithal. It would get into my head. I would feel so, you know, stressed and incapable about it, and it will probably send me crazy. Now, the interesting thing about John Wesley is when he tries for an example of this, how it gets in your mind, he says, I could never be a mathematician. He says, algebra would drive me crazy. It's kind of a strange illustration, but I suppose he just wasn't very mathematical, although in a moment I'll tell you that he was mathematical enough to understand how to give to God. So first of all, don't make money at the expense of life and health. Don't make money at the expense of your brain or your mind. And thirdly, it's wrong to make money by injuring others. So if you're an occupation which is exploiting others or hurting others, then Wesley would say, and I would agree with him, that that's not a Christian profession. There are plenty of jobs out there that are not suitable for people who have a Christian ethical and moral framework. Now, Wesley takes a swipe at three things: gambling, brewers, and there he's talking in particular about the gin makers of the time who sold their product on the basis that it was good for your health. Gee, that's changed. And pawnbrokers. We don't hear too much about that last category anymore. But probably there's merit in his swipe at those three. It would be interesting to see what list of no-go occupations John Wesley would create if he were living and preaching in the year 2005. Maybe some things would not change and some new ones would be added to it. So rather than tell you myself, these are things that we have to consider for ourselves. So it's wrong to make money at the expense of your life and health. It's wrong to make money at the expense of your mind. It's wrong to make money by injuring others. But within these limits, make as much money as you can. And then save as much as you can. Now, Wesley says that the opposite of saving is wasting. And here, really what he's saying is that a lot of people, and this would be true today, and of me too, no doubt, spend money on things that are really trivial and unnecessary, and you ought to cut them out of your life. Wesley's list is fancy clothes, gluttonous feasts, and spoiling your children. So that was 1770. I wonder what his list would be today. See if you're scared children at the moment, but that's... So save all you can. Make all you can, save all you can, and then thirdly, give as much money as you can. The first two rules are not enough. Saving without using it is just simply throwing it away. Having made and saved all you can, give away all you can. And Wesley says this is how you should do it. First, provide sufficient food and clothing for yourself and your family, or your household in that case. Well, I think he says food for your wife, children and servants. I think that's what he actually says, which is interesting. If there's a surplus after you've provided for your household, then use what remains for the good of your Christian brothers and sisters. And if there's still a surplus after that, then do good to all people as you have the opportunity. Now, Wesley set the example himself, although he's too modest to mention it in his sermon. But we know that he worked out early in his preaching life that he and his family, or his household, needed £28 a year to survive. Okay? Pound was worth a lot in those days. £28 a year, that's what he needed to survive. Well, at that time, his annual income was £30. So he said, well, I need £28 for my household, so I'll give £2 to the church. That's quite interesting, because it's less than a tithe, right? So he started with his household, and he gave the balance to the church. But sometime later, when he was well-known and popular and people were giving him money to support his ministry, his annual income rose to £60. How much did he give to the church? £32. Right? In other words, he still lived on £28. The whole of his life, there was no inflation in those days, evidently, the whole of his life he lived on £28 because that's what he needed. The rest he gave away. Now, as usual, John Wesley's not far off the mark in understanding how God wants us to think about money and many other things. So within the limitations that are imposed by acting Christianly, we must make as much money as we can, save as much money as we can, and give as much money as we can. Finally, a story from Steve Bradbury, National Director of the Aid Agency TIER. Steve tells the story of being in the boys' choir at his Anglo-Catholic church. One day they were taking up the offering, and after receiving the bags containing the collection money, the vicar's next task was to carry them on a large golden platter up the steps into the chancel. Now this he accomplished with his usual dignity. Then all he had to do was hold the hopefully heavy platter aloft, say a prayer, and place it on the altar. Normally all this was accomplished without a hitch. But on this occasion, the gloriously unthinkable happened. In the act of raising high the plate, the reverend gentleman's trousers fell down. Steve and his insensitive choir boy companions were beside themselves with mirth. Fortunately for the vicar, this was an Anglo-Catholic church where the clergy wore a cassock and surplice. So the congregation, also Anglo-Catholic, were somewhat in the distance, and they didn't see it, unlike the choir boys, so they were quite unaware of the gravity of the situation. That's Steve's pun, but I thought it was good. Well, the vicar may have lost his trousers, but he certainly hadn't lost his marbles, and so with commendable presence of mind, he quickly dropped to his knees in what looked like spontaneous prayer. He fumbled under his cassock until he had a firm hold of his trouser belt, and then in one smooth movement, he stood up while dragging his trousers up at the same time. His relief was matched only by the choir's disappointment that the situation had not deteriorated further. Steve goes on to say that when it comes to money and the church, stress is more common than mirth. By and large, money is still seen as a very private affair. But Steve says the Bible does not run away from the subjects of money, wealth and poverty. Indeed, few issues are given more comprehensive coverage. And if we're to treat the Bible with the respect it deserves, as the authoritative word of God and as a manual for our living, then it's essential that we allow it to scrutinise our handling of money. If the way in which all Christians created and used wealth was determined by biblical principles, the impact upon the poor would be phenomenal. For a start, Steve says, there would be no poor within the worldwide community of the church, which means that for more than 200 million Christians, the struggle against poverty would be over. Moreover, the church's capacity to respond to the needs of the poor outside the church would be multiplied beyond recognition, and for countless millions, the gospel message of God's love would be powerfully demonstrated. For this to happen, we need to follow the urgent advice of Paul. That is, focus our ambitions on building up treasure in heaven rather than on earth, being rich in good deeds, and generous and willing to share. Or as Wesley said, within the limits placed on us to live Christian lives, make as much as you can, save as much as you can, give as much as you can. Amen.